Good afternoon. Welcome to Your Turn. This is our special edition, an international roundtable discussion about what is going on in the Middle East. There is always something going on in the Middle East that makes the news. That's why we talk about it here. In the studio with me is Jerry Gordon. He's a frequent guest here on Your Turn. Welcome to the program, Jerry.
Good to be here.
And joining us online, and I believe we have all three of them here. I'll go through one at a time. Ted Bellman from Toronto. Are you on the line with us?
Hi.
Okay. Joey, turn that up just a tad bit because it's too quiet on the, on our end. Ted Bellman is the editor. Jonathan Schanzer, are you with us?
I am.
All right, with the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And Dan Diker from Jerusalem. Have we got you on the line as well?
You do. Thank you.
Very good. Okay, Dan Diker is the foreign affairs analyst and the director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs and the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. We'll begin with Jerry, who is sitting with me here in the studio. There's always something going on in the Middle East, as I said, and we now, with this new president, President Obama, making, I don't know, is overtures the right word towards the Muslim community? What's happening here? Is this a complete change in American foreign policy?
Looks like the beginnings of possibly the end of a special relationship that the United States has had with Israel since the end of the famous Six-Day War in June of 1967. It's not all that clear, and I'm sure some of our panelists, particularly John Schanzer and Dan Diker, as well as Ted, will address that issue. But before we start in that endeavor, let's discuss essentially the stunning development that occurred over the course of the last 3 days. Here is Israel attacking armed convoys conveying rockets to Hamas in, guess where, the Sudan. And as a result of disclosures this weekend, we now find out that Israel used essentially some of its advanced unmanned aerial vehicle technology essentially to accomplish this mission. What is not lost on a number of us is that the stage length for this attack is nearly equidistant between Jerusalem and Port Sudan on the one hand and Tehran on the other. And basically, we also find out from other sources like Al Jazeera and a London-based Arab publication today that there were not one but possibly three attacks, including the obliteration of an Iranian ship carrying more rockets and arms essentially to Port Sudan for transit to essentially ultimately Hamas in Gaza. That, we think, has sent a rather telling message essentially to Iran, and potentially an item of importance, essentially, to the Obama administration and particularly the State Department and Defense Departments in that regard. I want to first reach out to John Schanzer because John had an interesting solution, in part, for the weapons smuggling activity between what is Egypt and Gaza. Want to discuss that, John?
Sure. I've been hearing this a little bit from military circles in Israel, and that is that currently the strategy of trying to take out the smuggling tunnels for Israel has been to simply bombard them, hit them from above, or perhaps drop an explosive charge into an area where through sonar equipment that you can hear the echo, and they drop a explosive in and try to destroy the tunnel with one bomb or with maybe several pounds of explosives. This has not worked thus far for the Israelis because the Palestinians just simply go back in, dig through the tunnel, and rebuild it. So what I've been hearing from the Israelis is that perhaps it's time to flood this area. It's called the Philadelphia Corridor, and it is a 10 or 12 mile area, the border between Gaza and the Sinai. And the idea would be for Israel to dig a moat and allow the sea waters of the Mediterranean to come flooding in. And this would essentially collapse all of these tunnels and not allow for them to be rebuilt.
Well, that's an interesting and rather elegant solution, perhaps, to this continuing and nettlesome problem. I also gather, John, that there was an agreement reached between the U.S. and Israel on the cusp of the new Obama administration between outgoing Foreign Minister Livni and also former Secretary Rice. Do you want to talk about that?
Which one are you referring to?
Well, I think it's the one that basically the U.S. and Israel inked regarding, quote, international assistance in terms of the smuggling across the Egyptian border into Israel, into Gaza proper.
Well, you know, we know that there's been a lot of cooperation, ongoing cooperation between Israel and the United States on this. I don't know if maybe Dan has more information on this, that, you know, specifically between Condoleezza Rice and Livni. But we know that the United States has been actually providing assistance to the Egyptians, trying to help train more engineers and more of their servicemen to try to identify where the tunnels are and to interdict the weapons before they get through. What's interesting is that we've been hearing reports that there's been progress, and this is the first time I've heard it coming out of the mouths of Israeli officials, that they're more satisfied now than they have been in the past. Unfortunately, though, the smuggling continues to take place, and I don't see this stopping anytime soon.
I think to put a piece of history on this whole dilemma, I was informed by somebody here in Pensacola, who used to be a deputy commander on the U.S. Army screening force for the DMZ, that it was not only the problems that Israel has contemporaneously with Hamas and Gaza on the weapons smuggling side, but apparently for years the North Koreans dug tunnels underneath the DMZ as well. And, of course, the U.S. never came up with an adequate solution for that other than the certain technology they adopted. I think that's an illustration that underlines essentially what the Israelis are now talking about, building the moat.
There's one thing that I'd like to comment here.
Sure.
First of all, when I hear reports from the Israeli government that they feel things are fine, I take it with a grain of salt because they're always putting a positive spin on things. One of the most disturbing news reports that I've gotten, if news it can be called, I think I've read about it in two places, was the pressure that Obama was putting on the Kadima government to stop the Operation Cast Lead when they did. And the reason is, and this is the interesting part, is that the same as the Kissinger notion. He didn't want a total defeat for Egypt in the 70s. And here, Obama didn't want a total defeat of Hamas because they wanted to leave the door open for the approach to the Muslim world, and for that matter, to Syria. And they felt that if Hamas was absolutely totally destroyed, the Muslims couldn't accept the outreach.
That's interesting, too.
It's interesting that you raised that, Ted, because there's also another explanation for why Israel stopped its operation when it did. I don't think that it was discussed enough in the media here that Operation Cast Lead stopped short just ahead of the Obama inauguration. And I found this to be very interesting, that, you know, usually when an allied military launches a war, one would expect the United States to support that war until the military objectives are achieved. It appeared, now no one has corroborated this within the Obama camp, but it appeared that Israel was asked to curtail its operations so that it would not overshadow the Obama inauguration. Now, again, no one has confirmed this, but it seemed very strange of the timing and the fact that the objectives had not yet been met.
Well, there's another issue.
Just put some more sinister spin, if you will, that it's more than just so you're fighting on inauguration. It gives ulterior motive to it.
Dan Diker?
Well, we need to. We do all need to remember that the Israeli elections were really in the offing as well, and that I did hear the assessment that Jonathan Shanzer just offered us here as an informal as his assessment. I did hear that type of talk here among in military circles as well. It was also reported by analysts in our press and more than one source. But there is an Israeli strategic and political objectives that were also at play. First of all, there was a mad race in this last election. Remember, we were only weeks away from a really fateful Israeli election. I think that there were three candidates. Of course, the defense minister, Mr. Barak, who is continuing as defense minister in this current coalition, that was just minutes ago finalized. The cabinet was finalized for that coalition. as well as Mr. Netanyahu and Mrs. Livni. All three were competing, and clearly Mrs. Livni and Mr. Barak had had different understandings of how the war would play in their own to their own constituencies in this election that in the end neither of them won. But it was clear from Mr. Barak's point of view from the very beginning that he did not want to carry the cast-led operation, what was called cast-led in Gaza, to its ultimate conclusion, which would have been killing the Hamas leadership and sending a very strong message that of deterrence by doing that, and then essentially unseating the Hamas, the Iranian-backed Hamas government in Gaza. His strategy was to leave Hamas castrated, neutralized, weakened, to face the Gazan people and basically answer to them why so many of their people had been killed with no achievements. Unfortunately, it seems that the opposite has happened, and the perception on the Palestinian street is that the Israelis lost and the Hamas survived the Israeli so-called onslaught. And I think it has had a boomerang effect on Israel, where Israel has lost international sympathy in a major way. And the Hamas leadership, according to our head of military intelligence, has successfully smuggled in tens of tons of both raw material and weaponry and ammunition into Gaza since the ceasefire.
I have heard that, too, that they have brought in tens of dozens, if not thousands, of rockets, and all they're doing is rearming. And the question that I have is this. Eventually, there is going to be military action in Gaza again. Only a fool would say that there will not be. So what's the benefit to Israel of stopping their military action in Gaza, only giving the enemy time to rearm? Why not keep up the military pressure?
Well, there's a strong reason for that, according to the school of thought that says that a weakened, neutralized Hamas leadership is better than a politically empowered Fatah leadership. Because at the end, Jonathan Schanzer is a big expert on this point, having just written an important book on the Hamas-Fatah competition for power. At the end, Hamas and Fatah are not all that different one from the other in terms of the Iranian-backed groups that back each of those groupings. However, in the perception of the international community led by the United States, the perception is that the far more moderate group is the Palestinian Authority, which is, of course, a manufactured, repackaged version of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and its leading Fatah faction. And the truth of the matter is that from a military point of view, it's simply not true. However, from a political point of view, Israel would come under much greater political pressure in the event that the Hamas Hamas leadership were killed. Hamas, the Fatah sort of rode in on the back of Israeli tanks and reinstalled as they were until 2007 as the sort of governing power in Gaza. The situation would be no better for Israel. However, Israel would, because of the misperception, the misunderstanding in the international community regarding the moderation or the perceived moderation of Fatah, Israel would come under political pressure to start, you know, re-engaging in this political process to reconnect Gaza to the West Bank, which, in my assessment, it will be the position of this government to divide once and for all Gaza from the West Bank, because you basically have the Iranians are using Gaza the way they're using sovereign state of Lebanon, which is an Iranian base.
Well,
the idea of a two-state solution is really no longer relevant. But with a potentially Fatah government in a defeated Hamas situation where the Hamas is defeated, the perception is that we should get back on the political train and move towards a two-state solution again.
Well, and President Obama has called for that two-state solution, as did President Bush. When we get back from this short break, I want to ask, is this a real change in policy? And I also want to find out, just who do they expect this two-state solution to be with? Fatah, Hamas, the Palestinian Authority? Just what's up their sleeve? We'll ask that question and get those answers as this international roundtable discussion continues on your turn on 1330 WEBY. Okay, good afternoon. Welcome back to this international roundtable discussion here on today's edition of Your Turn. Jerry Gordon, who is a contributing editor to Israel Pundit. He's in the studio with me, joining us from Toronto, Ted Bellman. He's the editor of Israel Pundit. Jonathan Schanzer from Washington, D.C., with the Jewish Policy Center. And from Jerusalem, Dan Diker. He is the foreign affairs analyst and director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs and the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Quick question here, kind of posed to the entire panel, and that is this. President Obama has called for a two-state solution, as did President Bush. So my two-part question is, was President Bush just faking it, or did he really believe that that was the solution? And the second part of the question is, who forms the government of the second state?
Can I address that first?
Yes, please do.
Background and context. When Bush came to office, he was very reluctant to engage in the peace process because of the experience with Clinton, and put so much effort in and capital in, and he didn't succeed. Now, all that changed when the U.S. wanted to invade Iraq following 9/11, and they had to negotiate with Saudi Arabia for their permission to do so, and the end result of negotiation was the production of the Saudi plan, ascribed to Saudi Arabia, but in my opinion, really drafted by the State Department. Now, Bush was reluctant in following the roadmap which incorporated the Saudi plan, and he was really doing it to advance his agenda in terms of the war on terror. It was only at the end where he was forced to go for the Annapolis conference. So he never really had his heart in it, is my opinion. On the contrary, Obama does.
John,
so others can comment on that.
John Schanzer, do you have another view?
Yeah, I've got lots to say about it, and you know, essentially wrote a book about it. You know, I believe that the notion that there is even a unified Palestinian national identity is a farce, and this is something that has been forwarded by professors here in the United States and by the Palestinian media and by advocates of the Palestinian cause. This is not to say I think Israel would probably welcome at this point a Palestinian unified national identity, but we just don't have one. The two primary factions are, in fact, still at war with one another. Things have been quiet between the two factions in the West Bank and Gaza, but we've now seen an extension of their war into the Palestinian diaspora, into places like Lebanon, where we saw a bombing last week of a PLO figure by Hamas, who then would not allow for even this person's funeral to take place inside the Gaza Strip. So we continue to see this animosity play out between these two primary factions. So, you know, when Obama calls for, talks between Israel and the Palestinians, we continue to not know who the Israelis should deal with on a political level. And then there's, I think, and we've just implied this in the previous segment, and that is just exactly how do we even reconcile the fact that we've got a West Bank state and a Gaza state, and one is controlled by Fatah, the West Bank is, and Hamas controls the Gaza Strip. So even if you deal with one and then not the other, you're essentially leaving out half of the Palestinian population. And I don't see these two areas coming together anytime soon. The Israelis aren't interested in it. The Palestinians continue to war over it and are not going to agree on how to unify a government or the intelligence apparatus or the police or the governments. So we've got ourselves a very messy situation, and I believe that the Obama administration needs to take an important first step in at least recognizing the mess that has transpired inside the Palestinian political landscape.
Dan Diker, do you have something to add to that view?
Well, I think we should. I think that what Jonathan Schanzer said is not only accurate but really should be underscored. I mean, emphasized. I mean, this is the point. You know, one of the things that I have tried to emphasize in my own analyses and writings, and some of those of my colleagues at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, is the fact that from Hamas's own point of view, they look at themselves as an Arab de facto sovereign state with an Islamist regional profile, and really don't look at, in my assessment, don't look at themselves really as part of the national Palestinian discussion anymore. I think that their Islamist identity, defined as both by being the local chapter of the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as being more and more influenced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, if not in its Shia penetration, but certainly as a surrogate, joined at the hip in the, you know, in this war between Islam and the West. And therefore, from Hamas's point of view, from the certainly the external leadership's point of view, beginning with Khalid Mashal, who is a full-time paid employee of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in Tehran, they look at Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas, his nom de guerre is Abu Mazen, of course, and Salem Fayyad, who has recently submitted his resignation, as apostates. No different than even worse than the infidels of the West. So one can make the argument that the hatred and the enmity and the warfare and the civil strife and the fractionalism between Hamas and Fatah is actually as bad and potentially much worse than the Palestinian Authority view of Israel, certainly from the government standpoint. And therefore, we really have a three-state solution, as John Bolton suggested in his path-breaking Washington Post article of about 2 months ago, in which we have, you know, you've got a de facto Gaza state with its father saint, Iran, managing and directing and training, and then you have a corrupt, weakened, secular PLO state in the West Bank that is essentially being protected by the State of Israel today. And therefore, the notion that you could in some way create the traditional Oslo period concept of a two-state solution is simply not relevant anymore. And the Obama administration would do itself a great justice by rethinking this entire calculus and perhaps trying to come to some sort of understanding on the West Bank, which is what Rabin had wanted. Itzhak Rabin, of blessed memory, had wanted to do.
All right, we're going to resume this conversation on the other side of CNN when your turn continues on 1330 WEBY. Good afternoon. Welcome back to this international conversation we are having here at WEBY. We have in the studio is Jerry Gordon. He is a frequent guest here on WEBY talking about what is happening in the Middle East. He is a regular contributor to Isra Pundit. Ted Bellman is joining us from Toronto. Ted is the editor of the blog Isra Pundit. Jonathan Schanzer from Washington, D.C. is the executive director of the Jewish Policy Center. And from Jerusalem, Dan Diker. He is a foreign affairs analyst and the director for the Institute for Contemporary Affairs and Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Jerry, let's talk about Syria.
Yeah, let's talk about Syria, which is now bubbling up in the news again, although it's the umpteenth time. I'd like to asked the panel their reaction to a number of news reports, and most immediately the stunning New Yorker article by none other than Cy Hirsch, sort of questionable as an intelligence guy, nonetheless ballyhooing essentially the Obama opening to Syria. Let's start with you, John Schanzer. What's your reaction to this, and what is it that you think the State Department is really doing?
Well, the State Department recently sent first John Kerry, Massachusetts senator, over there, who came back gushing about the potential for peace with Syria. And then Hillary Clinton sent over two senior State Department officials. One was Jeffrey Feltman, the other one was Daniel Shapiro. Feltman is from the State Department, and Shapiro is from the National Security Council. They've come back and are now doing a tour on Capitol Hill explaining the opening that now exists, supposedly, for peace with Syria. This is, in a sense, an episode of Back to the Future. If you think back to 1992, the beginning of the Clinton administration, this was the same approach to the Middle East. The idea here is that if Syria goes in the way of peace, then so will go the Palestinians and the rest of the Middle East. Syria continues to look like a linchpin, and it primarily stems from the fact that the biggest conflict, at least the identifiable conflict, is the Golan Heights, a plateau that Israel is in theory willing to give up in the name of peace. In reality, however, we know that the Syrians are in bed with the Iranians. They support Hamas, they support Hezbollah, and they actually also have a very different interpretation of what the Golan Heights entails. What we've seen time and time again is that negotiations with the Syrians are more about the process and not really about the end goal of peace. And this essentially is going to remain the problem for the Obama administration. I think that they are chasing ghosts.
Dan Diker, what's the view from Jerusalem, where you are, in terms of what the U.S. is doing, and is it being coordinated with Israel?
No, I don't think. Well, it might be. It might have been coordinated with the prime minister. It would be the prime minister for the next 16 hours. But but I don't think that it would certainly would be coordinated with the incoming coalition under Mr. Netanyahu. I think that the Netanyahu coalition certainly the security-minded ministers that he has. You know, whether it's himself or former Chief Staff Yalon, who's just been appointed the Minister for Strategic Affairs, and certainly not Mr. Lieberman, understand that Syria has been playing a double game. And, you know, from Israel's point of view, and certainly in the point of view of this incoming coalition, the problem is not a problem of territory. I think that the U.S. administration, according to what we see and hear, has got the paradigm wrong. We're not in a territorial conflict anymore. We're in an ideological conflict in which the players are lining up, you know, they're lining up either with Iran or they're lining up with the West. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have made that very clear in the Gaza chapter of this ongoing war that ended nominally on January the 20th. And so, therefore, you look at Syria. We look at Syria from here not as a an opponent in a territorial conflict, but as the major and main primary Arab facilitator of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Syria, from its point of view, the way Israel looks at it, has not given up anything. In fact, it's gained everything without having to give up anything. And it's clearly, from Israel's point of view, Syria wants the process, does not want peace. Needs the process to get America off its back about the Hariri assassination. To get it, they want to be much more welcome, which they are now. They were walking. I mean, Assad was walking in the Champs Elysees with President Sarkozy not long ago, just weeks ago. And so, therefore, Syria's international legitimacy desires are being met without having to give up anything. And I think that this is what Assad has said to Cy Hirsch in not so many words. Stop looking for excuses to chase down those who are supplying Hezbollah with weaponry, and start looking for the possibilities for peace. Well, I think that Assad really understands the difference between people whose greatest commodity is the possibility sometime in the future of peace versus people who take a hard look at what the geopolitical reality is on the ground and whether that is in any way suggestive of possibility of a peace process in the model of Egypt.
Ted?
Let me jump in here, if I could, with an added point. The West has been trying to lower the bar for a reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah. And just this week, Hamas made it extremely clear that they are not going to abide by former agreements, which was one of the terms. That's hugely significant for the peace process, and it also reflects the thinking in Syria and in Iran. If they're not going to respect all these former agreements, essentially that's the end of the peace process. Now, further than that, America has certain problems that they're trying to take a different approach to, namely with Iran. On the one hand, they would like Iran to cooperate somewhat in Iraq, and they'd certainly like them to cooperate in Afghanistan because Iran seems to be the only access. So I read an article this week to the effect that America is hoping to enter a whole new era of a whole new deal with Iran, where Iran becomes a partner of America instead of Israel, and at Israel's expense.
Well, that's kind of an interesting revelation, Ted, but how do all of you square what Iran is really doing in the Middle East with its relentless nearly 30-year war against both the United States as well as Israel proper? Any comments?
Well, I'll jump in for a second here.
That's why America wants to switch gears. If you can't beat them, join them, essentially. So I'll let the others comment.
Well, you know, I don't think Iran is actually even hiding what it's doing. You know, the message that President Obama sent to Iran on Norwoz on the Iranian New Year was essentially accepted with a Bronx cheer by the Iranian leadership. They were not interested in talking about peace, and they essentially thumbed their nose at the offer. So they're not hiding what they're doing. But I think getting back to your previous point, Jerry, is that I think what we're beginning to see here is a sense on the part of the Obama administration that it's time to throw the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, the Bush administration may not have articulated its goals very well with regard to the rogue regimes of Iran or Syria or even North Korea. But their policies were probably right on target, and that is, do not reward them, do not talk to them, do not give them any quarter until they begin to curb their behavior. And what I think we're doing right now in the name of whitewashing America's image is engaging with these organizations and countries and really undoing a lot of the good work that had been done over the last 8 years.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question on the video that you mentioned that President Barack Obama sent to the people of Iran on the holiday of Nowruz. My question to you is this. What did the people of Iran see Barack Obama holding in his hand? Did they see him holding, and I'm speaking figuratively, of course, did they see him holding an olive branch, or did they see him holding his hat? Was he going
to... Well, they saw him holding the hats of the tyrannical leadership that's imprisoning the people of Iran.
Absolutely.
And that's, if you look at some of the blogger traffic that's come out of the opposition websites in Iran, it's excoriates the United States for making fools out of the Iranian people. Because for Barack Obama to make no distinction in his holiday greeting, which, by the way, the holiday of Nowruz is, and I'm no great expert, but I understand was a Zoroastrian holiday that is an anathema to the current Islamic leadership of Iran. And therefore, you know, not only is he not understanding revolutionary Shiite culture, but he's actually grouping the people of Iran who want to free themselves from this horrendous messianic tyrannical regime that is ruining their lives and their country, together with the regime itself. So what they've essentially done is to congratulate the jailkeepers and to torture the inmates.
Interestingly enough, there was a piece in part of a column by Brett Stevens that I think a number of you probably read last week, in which he interviewed an Iranian blogger whose colleague died 2 days before Obama did his video pitch to the Iranian people. And the thing that I noted was the comments from this individual that said to, in a form of a letter addressed to President Obama, that the U.S. may have had its gitmos, but Iran has hundreds of them. And essentially it means that anybody in opposition essentially to the Malakri basically has only one place to go, that's to jail.
You know, you raise a very good point. And, you know, Michael Rubin, who is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, wrote a tremendous book about the democracy movement in Iran, and it's called Into the Shadows, Radical Vigilantes in Khatami's Iran. And this, of course, is referring to the previous president of Iran. But the same holds true today, and that is that the Iranians will do whatever they can to break up democracy discussions among the students, among the younger generations. They will put them in jail. They will break elbows. They will, break kneecaps, etc. And then they will put them in jail. And this is exactly what happened in 2001. It's still happening today. And I think that you're right. I mean, these are the gitmos of Iran, and they are just not being talked about in this country. We are so interested in punishing ourselves for things that have happened in the past rather than looking at what our enemies are doing. And this is a real shame.
And is there any real hope of regime change in Iran without it coming from within? I don't think we can impose any kind of regime change. I'm not sure militarily. Of course, I don't think we would do it, even if we could, under the present administration, but do you think there's any hope for regime change in Iran without it coming from dissidents within its own borders?
Well, I don't believe that there's even a chance of that, given the way that we've imposed sanctions thus far. Our sanctions regime has been intended to make things more uncomfortable for the middle class so that they will rise up. However, if you dig a little deeper and you look at the way our sanctions are imposed on the Iranian regime, it is enough to make things uncomfortable, but not enough to break the back of the Iranian economy. And the reason for that is we're afraid of what it would do to the oil economy. So the sanctions are not strong enough. And meanwhile, the government, as we just talked about, is brutal with its dissidents. So the dissidents, they don't have enough leverage at this point to really launch their own counter-revolution inside the Islamic Republic of Iran. So it's for this reason that I am actually very pessimistic about change coming from within right now, unless we do more to make things extremely uncomfortable financially and politically for the mullahs of that country.
Basically, we do have something that we can employ, as you just described it, to ratchet up the sanctions, and that's the gas moratorium that have been suggested by several congressmen, notably Representative Kirk of Illinois and Andrews of New Jersey here in the United States. And allegedly, President Obama was, quote, in favor of doing something like this, but we have seen very little out of the State Department pushing this along. Any comments?
I don't see any sanctions whatsoever bringing down the mullahs with the Revolutionary Guard. I don't see a substitute for actually going to war with them and defeating them, because as long as they're there with their power and their strength, no amount of sanctions will undermine them.
John Schanzer?
Well, you know, again, I think that, you know, there are a number of congressmen out there who have the right idea. And some of them have been working with a think tank here in Washington called the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which has been doing, I think, a very good job of trying to lobby some of the oil companies that work with Iran to cease their work, to cease importing oil or refining oil for the Iranians. And the congressmen have been getting behind these initiatives. And it would be wonderful to see them work, but they will not work unless there is a commitment on the part of our State Department, but more importantly on the part of our Treasury Department, a department where I used to work, and there is not a commitment to ultimately break the back of Iran. That is what is necessary. You need to essentially create an economic crisis. If you think that what we're going through here in the United States is bad, imagine that 100 times worse inside Iran, making it so uncomfortable that the mullahs cannot continue to rule. That's what would be necessary in order to bring them down. And we are fearful of doing that for obvious reasons. You know, our economy is global. It is interconnected. And there is a fear of what it would do here at home if we were to break the back of the Iranian economy.
That is very short-sighted, because what if we're fearing $150 a barrel oil, and we're fearing it now, imagine what the price of oil is going to be when there's a mushroom cloud over, not necessarily an American city, any city, as a result of the Iranian nuclear program. 85% of Iran's government revenues come from the energy sector. And that country is totally dependent on international trade. It imports its own refined gasoline. Nearly 40% of the gasoline in Iran is imported. It's heavily subsidized. The Iranian people pay on average 20 cents on the dollar for that heavily subsidized fuel. If we would simply impose an embargo, and it would have to be global, that's part of the problem, is there's a handful of nations that would break it. But if we could truly impose a nothing-in, nothing-out embargo, sure, the price of oil is going to go up because nothing's coming out. But that is how we could topple the regime without having to do it militarily. Why can I see that and the administration cannot?
Well, I think a lot of people see it that way, and I think you're absolutely right. But one has to ask oneself right now how we've been fighting this war on terror. I mean, think about how the president, even right after 9/11, when we were asked what we could do to sacrifice for our country, we were told that we needed to go out and shop, that we needed to go out and support our economy. We have been and continue to be so fearful of what might happen if gas goes up over $200 a barrel. We fear the burden that the American consumer will have to bear. And we have to get out of that mindset, I think, in order to truly win this war.
The only way you could get out of that mindset is to initiate initiatives in terms of energy development here in North America.
That is something that we do need to pursue, but I don't see this administration pursuing it. We've got to take another break, and then we'll be back with our final segment of this international roundtable discussion when your turn continues on 1330 WEBY. Good afternoon. Welcome back to our international roundtable discussion about the Middle East and things going on in Israel with Jerry Gordon in the studio with me here at WEBY. He is a contributor to the Israel Pundit blog. Ted Bellman is in Toronto at this moment. He's the editor of the Israel Pundit. Jonathan Schanzer with Washington, D.C. based the Jewish Policy Center, and live from Jerusalem is Dan Diker. a foreign affairs analyst and director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs. Jonathan, let me ask you this question. This is probably going to be the last topic we're going to have time to discuss, and that is this. It has been confirmed by the White House that they are actively seeking to recruit Muslim employees to work at the White House and to work in policy positions. My question for you is, why?
Well, I think it's very simple. The image of the United States over the last 8 years has been, it's been soiled. Administration under George W. Bush was seen as somehow Islamophobic, even though I believe administration went to great lengths to include Islamic groups in the White House and on many occasions. But the sense is that the U.S. needs to do a lot to clean up its image, and this is one way that it seeks to do it. The problem is that so far the people that Obama has brought into his inner circle from the Islamic community have been, I think, not the right people to bring in, people who have ties to Islamist organizations, you know, that could have ties to violent groups. These are the exact wrong people to bring in, but we will need to see who he does bring in and whether they represent the right kind of Islam, and it'll be very interesting to see how he straddles that line.
Even if it is the right kind of Islam, would not this nation be going crazy if the White House said, we're going to recruit more Catholics, we're going to recruit more Mormons, we need more Jews in the White House, we need to get more Presbyterians working here? Why is it they're able to get away with, we need more Muslims here, when they couldn't pick another religion and get away with the exact same task?
Well, this belies the fact that we bend over backwards to try to please the Muslim world. And we continue to fail to do so because there really, in many ways, is no pleasing the Muslim world, because the Arab-Israeli conflict continues to exist. Because we are in a war of words with the Iranians or with the Syrians, or, you know, that the United States is fed up with Saudi Arabia over the price of oil, or the stranglehold that OPEC has over this country. But, you know, regardless of who is at fault in this conflict, we continue to try to bend over backwards to please the Muslim world. We are obsequious, and this is, I think, the exact wrong way to go about doing this. Our relationship should be based on mutual respect and based on action, not on quotas. And I think you're absolutely right to make that point.
Okay, I appreciate all of you joining me on the program. We've got to wrap it up here in 30 seconds. Jerry Gordon, Ted Bellman, Jonathan Schanzer, and Daniel Diker, our periodic international roundtable discussions.